This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. A top aide who has been traveling with U.S. President Donald Trump has tested positive for COVID-19, AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
One of President Trump's closest aides, Hope Hicks, has tested positive for the new coronavirus. That's according to an administration official who had to remain anonymous when discussing someone's health information. Hicks serves as counselor to President Trump. She traveled with him multiple times this week, including Wednesday for a rally in Minnesota and Tuesday aboard Air Force One for the presidential debate in Cleveland. Hicks had been the White House communications director but left the administration in 2018, soon after telling a House committee she had to tell white lies during her time at the Trump White House. Hicks, a former model, rejoined the administration this year ahead of the November election. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Meanwhile, President Trump says that he and First Lady Melania Trump are awaiting coronavirus test results. The head of one drug maker rushing to make a coronavirus vaccine is pushing back against President Trump's claim about when a vaccine will be ready. AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Top federal health officials have repeatedly said a vaccine's unlikely to be widely available until early next year.
I've spoken to the companies and we can have it a lot sooner. It's a very political thing.
One of those he mentioned at this week's debate is Pfizer, whose chief says he's disappointed the vaccine work being politicized. The AP obtained a letter Albert Bourla sent his U.S. employees trying to reassure them Pfizer will not bend to pressure to move more quickly. Bourla says the company is moving at the speed of science. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Find more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. This is VOA News. About 2,000 Honduran migrants hoping to reach the United States have entered Guatemala on foot. Immigration authorities say they crossed Thursday through the newly reopened frontier that had been shut by the coronavirus pandemic. Authorities had hoped to register them, but officials on hand were outnumbered, and the migrants hustled through without registering. Guatemala's president quickly vowed to detain them and return them to Honduras, saying they represented a threat to the health of Guatemalan citizens amid efforts to contain the coronavirus pandemic. The new group was reminiscent of a migrant caravan that formed years ago, shortly before U.S. midterm elections. The European Union has taken legal action against Britain over its plans to pass legislation that would breach parts of the legally binding divorce agreement the two sides reached late last year. The EU move Thursday underscored the worsening relations with Britain, which was a member of the bloc until January 31st. Both sides are trying to forge a rudimentary free trade agreement before the end of the year, but the fight over the controversial UK internal market bill has soured relations this month. The presidents of France, Russia, and the United States called Thursday for an immediate ceasefire between the ethnic Armenian forces around Nagorno-Karabakh. But Turkey's president said that the three big powers should have no role in the peace moves. Yeah, they called for an immediate cessation of hostilities between their relevant military forces and the heaviest clashes since the 1990s. France, Russia, and the United States are co-chairs of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's Minsk Group, set up to mediate in a decades-old conflict over the mountainous enclave in the South Caucasus. But in a speech to Turkey's parliament just before the three countries' statement, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said he opposed their involvement. Dozens of people have been reported killed and hundreds wounded since Sunday in fighting that has renewed concern about stability in the south area, a corridor for pipelines carrying oil and gas to world markets. Madrid will become the first European capital to go back into lockdown in coming days after the region's leader reluctantly agreed Thursday to obey a central government order to ban non-essential travel to and from the Spanish capital. Meanwhile, the rest of Europe faces a climb in cases and tighter restrictions. The city of over 3 million people is set to go into lockdown in the coming days after the region's leader reluctantly agreed to obey the regional law. Madrid has found itself caught in a fight between its national and local governments. More at voanews.com. By remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, October 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Rights groups in Tanzania are concerned about politically motivated violence ahead of the October elections.
We have some indication of electoral-related violence, but to me, I call these triggers of election violence. Now, if these triggers of election violence are not addressed immediately, then as a country, we might be in a very big problem towards polling days.
A new study says the contributions of pastoralists are often overlooked and underreported. We'll examine the details of a new agreement meant to increase the livelihoods of Ghanaian and Ivorian cocoa farmers. And Ghanaian cancer experts want more focus on colon cancer.
A lifestyle that exposes people to cancer kind of run through, regardless of which cancer you are referring to. So we may not be heavily focused on colon cancer now, but then we believe that the awareness we are creating is giving people the opportunity to adopt lifestyle that saves them from it.
And solar mamas brighten rural Malawi. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Human rights groups in Tanzania have called on the government and other stakeholders to quickly address what they say are the triggers of violence ahead of the upcoming October elections. Donna Bright, the U.S. ambassador to Tanzania, has also expressed concern about tensions and politically motivated violence in the run-up to the elections. Opposition groups have accused supporters of the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi or CCM party of attacking opponents. Both the police and the Electoral Commission have rejected the accusations as without merit. Onismo Olengurumua is the national coordinator for the Tanzania Human Rights Defenders Coalition. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that the elections could be disputed due to accusations that some officials of the Electoral Commission are biased and because there will be no international poll observers.
Yes, we have some indication of electoral-related violence, but to me, I call these triggers of election violence. Now, if these triggers of election violence are not contained or they are not addressed immediately, then as a country, we might be in a very big problem towards polling days. We need to take some serious actions to contain these triggers of election violence we've been observing for the last 1 week.
Onismo, some Tanzanians are saying the international community, including the U.S., should impose sanctions against officials in the government to stop issues of politically related violence. That will serve as a warning to anybody who engages in it. What do you say to that?
I'm not in a full support of having sanctions at this level, given the fact that we have not gone to the level of having an escalated or high level of election violence compared to what we've been observing in other parts of the Africa or other part of the world. Of course, we have seen some politically motivated efforts to create unnecessary election-related violence. But if we take actions swiftly, as what U.S. did and other groups, by advising and warning those who are behind those related electoral violence to do away with them, then I think we can contain the situation instead of going to have any sanctions.
Some Tanzanians are saying that the foreign envoys are interfering in the internal political dynamics of Tanzania by issuing out statements about concerns regarding the upcoming elections and its politically related violence. What do you think about this assertion?
First of all, it is very unfortunate that we are conducting general election without having a very good number of international election observers. You remember in the past election, 2015 election, we had EU election observers, we had the Commonwealth election observers, we have African Union, SADC election observers. All of them at this time are not in the country observing what is happening. Therefore, having diplomatic missions like the United States of America and other groups within the country trying to play that role is not a problem, because as of now, even the local election observers are not as what we normally used to experience in the previous election. So to me, I find like it is very common. It's for various missions to issue statements during elections, raising their concerns, advising, and on issues that they feel like if they're not addressed, at the end of the day, might put the peace of this country into something else that we have not experienced.
Onesmo Olenguru-Muan is the national coordinator for the Tanzania Human Rights Defenders Coalition. You're speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Dodoma. Cancer experts in Ghana say little attention is being paid to screening for colorectal cancer, leading to a high death rate for the disease despite its relatively low occurrence. They hope that the recent death of American actor Chadwick Boseman, the star of the Hollywood film Black Panther, might bring fresh awareness. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
By the time a patient comes to Dr. Clement Edusa with colon cancer, it is often too late. The medical director of the Sweden-Ghana Medical Center will see cancer that has been misdiagnosed and spread, as the patient has sought out other treatments, including some from ill-equipped small clinics or herbalists. Edusa says while Ghana does not see many cases of colon cancer, as lifestyles change, he expects to see an increase, and there needs to be systems in place to provide detection and affordable treatment.
Definitely there's going to be an increase, but don't forget that apart from that, you need to have a structure in place to do the screening. So if you don't have a national program which sort of pulls in the people to do the screening, you'll not get it early. So you'd have increasing numbers and people coming late and then, of course, having more fatalities.
While fans have been mourning the loss of Boseman, who died of colon cancer a month ago, a beloved actor and preacher in Ghana also met this fate this year. Bernard Nyako's son Gideon says his dad's illness was gradual. By the time he got his colon cancer diagnosis, doctors could do little as it had spread.
He went to the hospital, but they were not able to diagnose the main source of illness and stuff. But it was later that we discovered that it was colon cancer. That was 2019.
When Gideon saw images of Bosman's weight loss, he saw the similarities of how his own father looked toward the end. He hopes both his father's case and that of Boseman will create awareness of the need for early detection and better training in health services. Some organisations in Ghana have taken up this mantle. Cancer Support Network Ghana tries to get cancer survivors to speak out to encourage others to go for screenings to ultimately lower fatality rates in Ghana, says oncology nurse Eric Brubby.
People think that when you know, have this cancer, you are going to die. But there are people who have lived for many years. So when they come out to share their stories, it encourages others to also seek treatment.
Ibrahim Ralph from the Zurich Cancer Foundation focuses on low-income communities, advocating prevention, education, and the promotion of healthy lifestyles.
The lifestyles that expose people to cancer kind of run through, regardless of which cancer you are referring to. So we may not be heavily focused on colon cancer now, but then we believe that the awareness we are creating is giving people the opportunity to adopt lifestyle that saves them from it.
The ultimate hope is that more people will be aware of the signs and risks of cancers, including colon cancer, and that eventually all screenings, diagnosis, and treatments will be funded by the government. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
A new agreement between Ivory Coast and Ghanaian cocoa sectors is meant to increase producers' livelihoods, but Michelle Hendricks, founder of Farm Strong Foundation, says there are pitfalls. Hendricks spoke to Ricky Stryak about the details of the joint plan and what more should be done to help cocoa farmers in Ivory Coast and Ghana.
On the short term, you might conclude because the farmer gets more money for his cocoa, he will be happy. Doesn't mean an awful lot about his livelihood, because it depends on what can he buy and what will he buy of that. But what it is most likely the case is that when you increase farm gate prices like they have done now, the same thing has been done in the EU and in the US and Japan in the past. If you increase farm prices without the link to markets, you get very often into surpluses because there's no break on it.
Are you saying the partnership and the agreement is very flawed, basically?
Flawed, I think it's too strong a word. But if you subsidize farm products, which is like almost artificial, like you had in the EU, and that induces a production which you would normally not have. And in the EU, we had that with butter, with milk. You may end up with more production than the market can absorb, and that will lead at some point to a lower world market price, which makes the subsidies even more expensive than they already are.
What do you think would have been a better mechanism in order to help the farmers increase their livelihood? Well, because their percentage of the pie is quite small.
Then you have to look, why do cocoa farmers produce more than is actually needed? Who is pushing the production? It's often hidden behind the word productivity, but at the end of it's always production of cocoa and any other commodity. If you look at coffee and cashew, so these tropical smallholder commodities, they have been used as a way to improve incomes. So they have been subsidized with private money, but also with public money, with a very simple theory of change, by saying, well, if a farmer is poor, because he does 400 kilos per hectare, you know what? We're going to help him to produce 800 kilos per hectare, and therefore he's twice as rich, twice as happy, and twice as healthy. Well, that is unfortunately not the case if that increased volume is not consumed by the market, because otherwise you have pressure on the market. And if you look at all agricultural commodities, there is always pressure on agricultural commodities over time. The real value of food has been declining ever since. People start getting statistics on it. So if you want to influence prices or incomes, you should not do that with subsidies. That has never worked. Poverty itself is not a cause. Now, it comes from somewhere. With what is then the issue of these people or these economies or these landscapes? Ecosystems, if you like. And our conclusion is that is most of the time not agronomic.
That was Michelle Hendricks, founder of Farm Strong Foundation. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Switzerland. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 2nd. Pastoralists, people who raise livestock in the open and are often nomadic, are being overlooked as a benefit to world food security and biodiversity. That's according to a study released this week by the German-based League for Pastoral Peoples and Indigenous Livestock Development. The study, which looked at five countries, including Kenya and Uganda, says a scarcity of data makes it difficult to quantify the contribution of millions of pastoralists to economies, ecosystems, and wildlife. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
A new study calls for the proper recognition of pastoralist communities in their countries. The League for Pastoral Peoples and Indigenous Livestock Development, an NGO, commissioned a study of five countries to find the estimated number of pastoralists. The report, published Wednesday, finds that none of the governments use pastoralism as a category for data collection, making the pastoralist invisible and creating a data gap of millions of people, their way of life, and how they raise livestock. Jacob Wanyama carried out the research in Kenya and Uganda.
The study was actually provoked by a recognition that livestock keepers and especially pastoralists, normally their roles or their contribution to the national economies are not recognized, partly because their numbers in terms of the population, in terms of what they produce, are not usually captured in the national databases. Or if they are captured, they are not completely captured because of the fact that they are pastoralists and they are mobile, and that makes it difficult for them to provide this information.
The study also covered Germany, India and Argentina. Pastoralists move with their animals from one place to another in search of water and pasture. The animals purely depend on natural vegetation. Such traditional practices contribute to biodiversity. In Kenya, 4 million people who identify themselves as pastoralists rely on livestock, worth more than $1 billion. But the scarcity of data makes it difficult to quantify pastoralism contribution to ecosystem and wildlife services. Naomi Wako is a nominated senator from a pastoral community, Northern Kenya. She says national resources are divided based on population.
Like in Kenya now, what we call the revenue allocation is based on the population of the people. And because for us, our numbers have never been captured, most of the time people believe that we have, you know, a few people in our area and that we don't matter. So it has affected us in terms of education, because the schools are also built according to the number of the young people who go to school. Hospitals are also provided according to the number of people who need the services.
In 2019, the Ugandan government proposed abolishing nomadic pastoralism, saying such a practice was dangerous for communities that rely on it. The pastoral communities in Uganda's Karamojong region that mostly depend on the livestock criticized the move and said it violated their rights. Wako says people associate pastoralist communities with poverty due to their way of life.
We also have these natural calamities, you know, like the drought. Majority of our people are poor, poverty affects people, flood, you know, keeps on affecting us, and we lose our animals during the drought. People don't see the positive contributions.
Wanyama said most of the wildlife parks and conservancies that attract tourists are found in the pastoral areas, and that should also be considered their contribution to their country's economies.
First of all, the fact that pastoralists are mobile, and they are found in most fragile areas, which otherwise would not have been used for anything else but apart from the pastoralism. And then in the process, because of that, they are able to survive, to live with the natural resources there, wildlife, trees. They conserve all these things because some of them, they actually depend on them. Like, for example, trees, they provide medicines. So they conserve them.
The report calls on government around the world to support and strengthen pastoralist system with information, policies and investment to make the sector more sustainable. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
A group of Malawi women is changing lives in villages that have long lived without power by installing and maintaining solar equipment in homes and schools. The women, known as the Solar Mamas, were trained in India as solar engineers with sponsorship from charities. The solar power has allowed students in rural Malawi to study at night and for their families to earn more income. Lamek Masina reports from Lilongwe.
The women may look like ordinary villagers, but a chat with them reveals they are trained solar engineers. The Solar Mamas are helping to bridge the power gap in rural Malawi, a country where only 10% of the population is connected to the power grid. Charity groups, Barefoot, and Voluntary Services Overseas, or VSO, sponsored the women's six-month training in India. Ntisunge Ngoli managed the Solar Mamas program at VSO.
We trained the illiterate women because we believed that education is not just in the classroom. And we wanted to tell people that even women can be solar engineers. So we purposely selected older women that were above 45 years old and who did not go past 75.
The women have so far brought solar power to over 200 households in villages around Malawi's capital, Lilongwe. Aline Snapias is one of 8 trained solar mamas. She says the skills we learned from India are very beneficial to us because once we install or repair the solar equipment, we are given money that helps us meet our daily needs. The program helped some villagers get into the battery charging trade and remove lengthy travel to charge mobile phones. The Solar Mamas have also connected schools with solar power, allowing students for the first time to attend classes in the early mornings and evenings. Ethel Opil is a grade 8 learner at Chatsala Primary School in Lilongwe. She says the coming of solar power here has helped me a lot because in the past I was unable to study at night at home because my parents are poor and could not afford a lamp and a flashlight. But now I can come here at night to study and work on assignments. The Solar Mamas have also trained Malawi's youth in solar engineering so they can become the next generation of solar mamas and solar papas. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with Sunday's London Marathon, where African athletes are expected to dominate. Elite Kipchoge and Kenenisa Bekele will line up at the 40th edition of the 2020 London Marathon on Sunday for a long-awaited clash between two of the all-time greats of long-distance running. Kenya's Eliud Kipchoge is a defending Olympic men's marathon champion, world record holder, and the first person to run a marathon in under 2 hours. But Ethiopia's Kenenisa Bekele is a three-time Olympic gold medalist, five-time world champion on the track, and a reigning 10,000 meters world record holder. With two of history's fastest marathon runners set to clash at this year's London Marathon, focus is on whether a new world record will be set. Head of elite athletes at the London Marathon speaks on the possibility of a new world record in the marathon.
Obviously, with various restrictions in place due to COVID-19, we have to we can't run the race on our traditional course. So we have obviously adapted that slightly and obviously gone for this multi-looped course. So it has the potential to be very quick. It will depend on how the race develops and. Certainly, there's a focus on the head-to-head with Kenenisa and Eliud. So I think as the race unfolds, we'll get a better idea of is the world record possible? I think it is.
In the women's category, like Kipchoge, world record holder Bridget Kosgei of Kenya is back to defend her title in the British capital. Reigning marathon world champion Ruth Chepngetich and Olympic champion 5,000 meters runner Vivian Cheruiyot are two of the leading contenders in the women's elite race. Bridget Kosgei, the defending champion, spearheads a formidable Kenyan team.
Since last year when I ran Chicago, even last year I ran London, and I was really, really happy to be invited again to this London Marathon. I really like London because I hope I will do my best tomorrow to so that it will make me to be invited again next year.
For her part, reigning world champion Ruth Chepngetich is also confident that the unique London Marathon will turn out in her favor on Sunday. And out of football, Egyptian giant Al Ahly has hired South African Pitso Mosimane as their new head coach, the Cairo-based club announced on Thursday. The eight-time African champions parted ways with Swiss coach René Wheeler, who took over the club for a little over 1 year due to organizational reasons, the club mentioned in a statement. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, October 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Join a panel of prominent Washington journalists as they deliberate the latest top stories of the week. Issues in the News moderator Dan Raviv and a panel of experts will analyze issues such as the latest developments in the run-up to the 2020 presidential election. Don't miss Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.